Welcome to Guerrilla Radio, recorded July 19th, 2023. Well, in the early hours Monday local time, the bridge connecting the Crimean Peninsula to Russia was targeted for a second time, again killing civilians and forcing traffic closures. The first attack was done via suicide bomber in a large truck. This latest assault is more sophisticated, naval drones reportedly being used. Kyiv security sources have claimed responsibility for the attack, which comes as Russia's Black Sea Grain Initiative agreement with Ukraine expires, guaranteeing if Russia had a mind to, renewal will now not happen. Predictably, the European Union, United Nations, and the NATO countries all rolled out media releases condemning Russia, blaming it for, quote, using food as a weapon, and threatening emerging nations' food security. Glenn Michalchuk is president of both Peace Alliance Winnipeg and the Association of United Ukrainian Canadians, or AUUC. He's been active in the peace movement for 40 years, going back to Ronald Reagan's dirty wars in Latin America of the 1980s. Glenn Michalchuk in the first half, and Daniel Ellsberg, the man Richard Nixon once declared the most dangerous in America, died last month. Ellsberg famously leaked the so-called Pentagon Papers, revealing to the world the true face of America's war against Vietnam, Laos, and Cambodia. This month, a special whistleblower summit and film festival and legacy tribute to Dan Ellsberg is slated for Washington, D.C. Covert Action magazine, founded by the almost equally famous agent of revelation, Philip Agee, will be taking part, hosting the festival's final day event, blowing the whistle on covert warfare and coercive economic sanctions bonus day. Jeremy Kuzmarov is a journalist and author who also serves as managing editor at CAM. Jeremy's book titles include Obama's Unending Wars and The Russians Are Coming Again, written with John Marciano. He's also one of the star-studded Blowing the Whistle panel, honoring Daniel Ellsberg's commitment to uncovering U.S. crimes against humanity. Jeremy Kuzmarov and Blowing a Horn for the Whistleblowers in the second half. But first, Glenn Michalchuk and NATO's determination to stop peace breaking out anywhere at all costs. Well, welcome back to the program, Glenn.
Thank you very much for having me again.
Well, it's always my pleasure, of course. Now, Glenn, we spoke in February last as Canada's hawks were pledging more aid in for the Ukraine fight. They're pledging for the fight to the last with donations of war material and more. And Ottawa is not alone, of course, in that jingoism. All of the NATO nations are gung-ho for war, but as far as we know, it's only the Ukrainians and a small number of volunteers doing the dying. Last week, the Prime Minister Trudeau, reiterated Canada's so-called support for Ukraine. He again was emphasizing the martial nature of that support. You wrote a piece up at the Association of United Ukrainian Canadians website not too long ago, urging de-escalation and a ceasefire should be the goal, not throwing more arms into the fire, so to speak. What's your assessment of the Prime Minister's announcement of a week ago?
Well, unfortunately, Canada has stuck to this course of militarizing the conflict and seeing the conflict as a war, really, against Russia, and using Ukraine in that war. So it is, it's unfortunate that Canada has continued to take this position of renouncing the diplomatic efforts to end the war, renouncing efforts for a ceasefire, and renouncing any kind of opportunity to engage in discussions. So, for example, I mean, Canada's latest announcement is just adding fuel to the fire. They also reacted negatively to the Chinese proposal that came out earlier this year. And Canada is on the wrong side of this conflict. Canada and the NATO nations is on the wrong side of this conflict. And there, from the beginning, the Association of United Ukrainian Canadians, even before the war broke out, said the war could be averted through diplomacy and negotiations. And then once the war broke out, that was still the key. And that position is being joined by more and more countries around the world, especially the global south. And the African nations recently have made a peace proposal. Other countries are coming forward with peace proposals. So Canada, unfortunately, is an outlier to the question of peace in Ukraine.
Well, a press release from the Prime Minister's office says, and crows, I would even say, that at the Vilnius NATO summit last week, Canada announced a, quote, $541 million in new funding and projects to support Ukraine and strengthen transatlantic security. The new funding for Ukraine builds on the over $8 billion in, quote, multifaceted assistance Canada has dedicated since the beginning of 2022. You're a Canadian, but you're also of Ukrainian heritage. Canadians are getting weary of this, and other NATO nation citizens are getting concerned about how much of the money of their national treasury is being devoted to this and the cuts in services at home that are necessarily going to follow. What about within the Ukrainian Canadian community? Is there what's the position on this continual financial doling that the government in this country is meeting out?
Well, of that $8 billion that's referenced in that press release, at least $1 billion of that has been direct military aid. As for this other, the other enormous amount, $7 billion plus this $541 million that was announced, a lot of this is just to keep the Ukraine, the infrastructure of the country running. Because part of the war has not only been, part of the devastation of the war has not only been the immense casualties suffered by the Ukrainian army, the number of people that have died, but also the destruction of the economy. So the Ukraine needs this money to keep operating, to keep any semblance of a country together. So I think it just plays into this question that we have been saying in the AUC that end this war and you'll end a lot of the problems that have been associated with this war, including the economic this destruction of Ukraine that is going on. Now, how does it play within the Ukrainian community? We know that in Canada, there is a section of the Ukrainian community that has been very much pro-war, and this is often embodied in the statements of the Ukrainian-Canadian Congress. So no doubt they view these statements as very positive. The point being is that none of this kind of assistance and aid would have been necessary if it were not for the devastation that's been caused by the war, which has been an unnecessary war.
Well, from an economic perspective, it's much in the news now that the Black Sea Grain Initiative has ended. It was due to end. It was due to expire. That deal was an agreement that the Russians signed after the first attack on the Kerch Bridge, allowing that grain exports out of the Black Sea, which is essentially the Russian-controlled lake at this point, would be allowed. The deal, the second attack, though, occurring on the same day that this deal was set to expire, from an economics point of view, and the Ukrainian security forces have, as I said in the introduction, admitted that they were responsible for this attack. That seems like economic suicide to me.
Yes. Part the cancellation of this deal is in part related to the unfulfillment of the deal. The Russian government has pointed out that I think only about 3% of the grain that was destined for markets in Africa and the other countries of the global south, countries that desperately need this grain, only about 3% of that grain ever reached those markets. The other portion of that grain was diverted to European consumption. So that was one reason. The other reason, of course, part of that original agreement to facilitate the transportation of grain was the easing of restrictions on Russia's ability to export fertilizers and other chemicals related to agricultural production, which, by statements of the Russian government, said that that part of the deal was never implemented. So they gave two reasons for canceling it. Of course, the attack on the bridge made absolutely no sense, a completely civilian structure, and it actually resulted in the deaths of some at least at least two or three civilians, if I remember the press reports from that. But it is an example of this kind of activity that the Ukrainian armed forces have conducted against entirely civilian targets for no reason other than extracting some kind of punishment on the people in those areas.
Well, the way I understand it, though, this wasn't canceled. It was set to expire, which is important because it was set to expire exactly on the date of this attack, or the day after the attack. So, and it had been renewed already by Russia in May. They extended the agreement already with the understanding that it would expire on this day, and then they would presumably review it if they were going to extend it. So it wasn't like they canceled it because of the explosion. That's important, though, because this is the way it's being spun out. I've seen the BBC and the CBC and the American networks, too. It's all being as if they and the governments, the press agencies of the American and Canadian governments and presumably the rest of the NATO nations, it's almost as though they had everything prepared and ready to release to try to depict Russia to the rest of the world, especially the so-called emerging economies, as the heavy in all of this, because it's they that are responsible for starving the world as it's being put out and using, to quote the trope, food as a weapon, when in fact this second attack really made it impossible, I would argue, for Russia to extend a deal, even if they wanted to.
Yes, I agree. Because, and one of the things that's become very clear in the progress of this war, is exactly the point you made: is that the mainstream media, the media that's connected with the governments, with big financial interests and others, the mainstream media, has presented a particular narrative on this war. And yes, they have used this particular instance to portray it. It's pure disinformation on the part of the mainstream media. And it's just an example of the entire course of how the media has treated this war, presenting disinformation, misinformation, a very slanted and biased view towards everything that is done by NATO, as presenting that as correct and good and positive. So it has been part of the problem of developing the opposition to this war has been the way the mainstream media has controlled the narrative. Thankfully, there is independent media such as your show and other independent media, which continues to bring to the people the alternate views of what's really going on in this war, who's responsible, and what is happening.
Well, I'd like to think I was up to the task, but I, you know, faced with this barrage, this tsunami of lies coming from so-called respected sources like the Canadian Broadcast Corporation, the BBC, and the governments all involved. Well, if you've just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking today with Glenn Michalczuk. Glenn is president, as he said, of both the Peace Alliance Winnipeg and the Association of United Ukrainian Canadians, or the AUUC. Glenn's been active in the peace movement for more than 40 years, going back to Ronald Reagan's dirty wars in Latin America of the 1980s. Well, Glenn, I can say that I'm old enough to remember those dirty wars, and I'm old enough, too, to remember Ronald Reagan, and especially the latter years of his second term as president. And it was pretty much an open secret that that he was dementing, and for whatever ailment he had, he certainly wasn't all up or upstairs. It's sort of a sense of deja vu now when we're looking at Joe Biden in the Oval Office now, and it seems almost impossible that he could finish this term, let alone run for a second term. Are you getting that same sense of been there, seen that?
Yes. I mean, in terms of the nature of the United States and its actions in the world, nothing has changed. There was this period where there was some relative calm between the various wars of the United States. I mean, there was the two Iraq wars. There was the war in Yugoslavia. But this war has certainly taken on a much larger dimension. It has certainly been much more difficult for the United States to claim that it is being able to be win this war. So things, and there is this, there is a deep problems within the American political superstructure as to this war and to the to whether there's support for this war. So so the United States is having difficulties all around. And these next coming elections might be very interesting because they're besides the two parties, which are just really one party, the Democrats and the Republicans are really one and the same in terms of outlook. You know, there are other candidates moving forward. There's the candidacy of Cornel West and others, which will add a different dimension to this. So, and, you know, I should say that, you know, I know your time may be limited, but we have the same problem in Canada in terms of the politics here. There has been no party that has spoken out against this war in the Canadian Parliament. And that, too, is a factor in driving this war and enabling Canada to continue on this course.
Well, it's very divisive, but everywhere except the Parliament, where the chorus seems unbroken, even as the bills rise and rise. I mean, $8 billion plus that we're aware of being devoted to this war that should never have happened in the first place. Plus, Canada played a central role in the very earliest days of the Maidan coup. It is revealed that Canada was aiding and abetting, providing shelter and succor to the terrorists who fomented this uprising that ultimately killed more than 100 people within Maidan and then set a course of death and destruction that we've been following now that it amounts to hundreds of thousands of people being killed and maimed and displaced. The divisiveness, Glenn, of all of this, though, we've seen it within, I mean, nowhere more poignantly and disastrously than within Ukraine itself. But what about the divisiveness created by this issue within Canada's Ukrainian communities?
Well, yes. I mean, well, there's divisiveness within Ukraine itself. I'll just speak just very briefly on that. I mean, before the war began, and the war is partially about this question of NATO, Ukraine becoming a NATO member. Only about 40% of the Ukrainian people oppose that idea. But within the Ukrainian community in Canada here, yes, I mean, but these are historic divisions that go between back to the really the wave of immigrants that came after the Second World War, which brought these very kind of ultra-nationalist ideas into the Ukrainian community and have received immense support from the Canadian state for doing that. And they were brought here not only to Canada, but to Britain, the United States, for these very specific reasons. So there is this division between the progressive section of the Ukrainian community and this, of course, that section that's represented by those ultra-nationalist forces within the community. But I have to say, we have some contact with the new Ukrainian immigrants who are coming. And, you know, they reflect, first of all, a deep concern about the war, how it's affecting them. And at least the ones that we have met, there is no great aspiration to continue this war. So there is, because they are the direct victims of it at this point, there's the immense desire of them to have peace. And I'm not saying that's universal amongst all those that have come, but it certainly is something that we have noted in our contacts with them. And I would just have to point out that there was a recent government release about the relatively small numbers that have come to Canada, despite the large number of applications to come. And the interesting point is that others have gone back to Ukraine because they have not been able to fit well into the new culture of Canada. It's hard. It's hard for any immigrant to come and fit in, let alone coming under the duress of war. So,
well, and the government just announced yesterday that there was going to be more federal housing support for asylum claimants. The people coming from Ukraine fit into that category as asylum seekers?
Well, yes. My understanding is that the nature, the way the government changed the rules for the Ukrainian community coming from Ukraine, that they do qualify. They do qualify for that position of asylum seekers. Yes.
But you say that they are turning away from Canada, and then what? Going back to Ukraine or going to third countries?
I should clarify. The people who have come have decided to also return home because of their difficulty to find work here, their difficulty to, of course, many of them come with, low English skills. So there's been an actual difficulty to face here. Not only that, but they, of course, left often family back home. So there's been a desire to go back home because thinking that it's just easier to be there with family and in a situation that they, you know, is their home, right?
Well, I find that really surprising. I mean, we're seeing reports of press gangs roaming the streets of Kyiv and other cities within Ukraine, grabbing people and sending them off to the front. There's other reports of waves of people leaving Ukraine for anywhere to avoid not the Russian onslaught, but their own government. Is that overblown?
No, I don't think.
Or am I repeating Putin talking points?
No, you're not. No, it's not overblown. The very fact that men are conscripted right off the street into the army is the problem. So a portion of the people going back, the ones that I'm referring to, a lot of women came over with their children of various ages, either very young children or teenage children, because of the fact that men could not leave. There was a certain point where Ukraine would not allow any men to leave the country, at least, you know, legally leave the country. So some of the people that are returning, as I just noted that the press release from the government said that noted that there were people returning. But I would think that it's probably people who can return. So a lot of women came here, and I would suspect that of those returning, a portion of them are at least women.
Yeah. I watched a fascinating interview conducted by Aaron Mate over at the Gray Zone the other day with a former Ukrainian government official and diplomat named Andrei Teleshenko. Did you happen to catch that?
Yes, I did see parts of it. I had received a note to watch it, and I had received parts of it. I did watch parts of it, yes.
Well, in this interview, and it was a long interview, almost an hour and a half, this Teleshenko, he seems to be the guy that knows where all the bodies are buried, to use the old cliche, and he was talking about the corruption within Ukraine and the corruption of the American government, and specifically the current president, who as vice president was up to his blowholes in it.
Yes, I mean, that's been documented also by Seymour Hersh, the corruption within the Ukraine government. And it's been documented by others. Part of it is the reselling of these weapons that have been brought in by NATO. Part of it is just the corruption, the skimming of the immense number of dollars that have been used to support the Ukrainian economy.
Yeah, I don't think this is something that's commonly covered. Well, it's not covered at all in our popular media over here. But the resale of when the Canadian government stands up and goes, well, we're going to send these arms to Ukraine, that these will be resold to the highest bidder and show up, as some of the weaponry is showing up already within, you know, all over the world in the hands of some of the most nefarious people. Do we have any indication of Canadian weaponry showing up in terrorist hands in West Asia or Latin America or anywhere else?
No, I'm not aware of that. I mean, obviously that would require some, you know, very deep documentation and some investigation by journalists. But we do know that Canada, one of the weapons that Canada supplied to the Ukrainian army is howitzers. And howitzers, of course, are being used to deliver these cluster munitions. Mm-hmm. So Canada, despite its support of the ban on cluster munitions, in all likelihood, its weapons are being used to deliver them. And in all likelihood, some of the weapons that Canada has supplied possibly have been put onto the black market for use elsewhere.
Yeah, well, one of the issues when I was trying to reach for this idea that Canadians and other NATO country citizens were losing patience with seeing how much of the state coffer was being devoted to this war, and not necessarily just directly militarily, but also in resettling people, as was announced yesterday in this country, when there's thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of Canadian citizens living rough right now on the streets, and millions in our neighbor next door as well. And yet they are rounded up and moved along by police, and no accommodation made for them at all. And it's just adding to the disparity within our already fracturing so-called democratic capitalist countries.
Yes, very true. I mean, here in Winnipeg, there was a piece on the news this morning here about the number of homeless camps in Winnipeg. So Winnipeg has a population of about 600,000 people, 620,000, and there are over 70 homeless camps in Winnipeg. And in fact, part of the news report is that Winnipeg has a good reputation amongst homeless people because it is fairly tolerant within that description of homeless camps, unlike some other cities that move quickly to dismantle them. So actually, Winnipeg is attracting people to come here, homeless people, because of the relative stability of these camps, and they actually are serviced in various ways by various frontline organizations to help them. But this fact that the consequences that there, well, the point you make is very true. There's consequences to this war in Canada, and the consequences are that the great social needs in Canada are not addressed. And whereas Canada has billions to spend on this war in various ways, whether through direct armaments or through assistance to a country that has been destroyed by the war, that shouldn't have happened. But again, it comes down to who is speaking out on these things. And it's not being, powerful, where MPs, even if they had to speak out individually against the interests of their party line, none of them are doing that, though I'm sure there are members of Parliament of good conscience who could do that and should do that. And that's something that really strikes me, because in other countries, there are at least people speaking out against these things, political representatives in various forums, whether it's the European Parliament, to some limited extent within the United States system.
Yes, and the German representative, whose name I can't recall her name off the top of my head, but she gave a blistering account to the European Parliament recently, laying out the hypocrisy and one-sidedness of the way this issue is being presented.
Yes, very true. But here in Canada, we have this wall of silence. This wall of silence, and it's this wall of silence by otherwise probably good people that is enabling this war.
Well, how, Glenn, do people then, how do they get their voices heard? How do they connect with you guys there at the Winnipeg Peace and other like-minded organizations in their communities if they're not from Winnipeg?
Well, it's tough because the resources of the peace groups and that are relatively small and modest. I mean, none of us are full-time organizers in the peace movement, so it's tough. But having said that, there's consistent actions, consistent efforts by organizations across the country. Like there was several demonstrations across the country at the time of the NATO summit. There was the tour of Dimitri Lascaris, which went across the country, speaking of his opposition to the war and his trip to Russia to actually, I think the title of the talk that he gave was Building Peace with Russia, One Handshake at a Time. And so even despite the opposition to that tour, which none of the media covered, but there was, there was an ability in each of the cities that he visited for people to come out, and they were small attendance. But it's significant. So it's significant in that sense that people are despite the lack of ability to get their message across, people are still working on this. And one of the things that has been started here in Winnipeg is the Free Speech for Peace movement. As we see that people are being hounded and harassed for daring to give their views on the war.
And canceled, too. And then Dimitri's tour across the country was a prime example of that. Glenn, we're fast out of time. Glenn Michalczuk, again, is president of both Peace Alliance Winnipeg and the Association of United Ukrainian Canadians, or the AAUC. Look them up online. Thanks a lot, Glenn, for coming on and talking to us again, eh?
Thank you so much for the opportunity. It's always a pleasure. And it's important work that you do.
Well, thank you. And I look forward to our next talk. And I look forward, too, because I'm going to be speaking to Jeremy Kuzmara.